Hello and welcome into this Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host and sometimes present host for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity. Back in the studio after a rather lengthy absence last week. Wow, I only got 2 days in here last week because other outside stuff came up. First, it was, I knew there was going to be 2 days, then a surprise third day, all morning sessions. But hey, what do you do? As I've told you before, I get paid for the outside sessions. I don't get paid to be here. So, of course, I'm going to, and I'm working on my car, so I need all of the extra money I can get. So there we have it. And I was, so my apologies for being out for 3 days last week. I didn't call out sick. I called out employed. So, you know how that is, especially recently. If you can make a little money, you make a little money. And that's what I was doing. I would get through with the morning sessions. I'd grab a bite to eat and change into, my get greasy clothes and go work on the car for a little while. And that's how things are. So how are you? You doing okay? I hope you're doing fine. I hope we hadn't been together since almost a week ago, since last Tuesday morning. Pardon me. The life has just kind of separated us for a few days. But pardon me while I pet my dog. The it looks like everything is going to be back to mostly normal this week. I already, as of yesterday, I have something Thursday morning, so I won't be here Thursday. But every other day this week, things look like they're back to Abby normal. So hopefully everything will be fine otherwise this week. And I don't have any reason to believe otherwise, because this coming Thursday will put us, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ahead as far as the Dawson Now podcast is concerned. And there won't be that sense of urgency to book more sessions and interview more people. Okay, so that's hopefully that'll square things away. It has been a crazy time otherwise. I've told you about the Miata project. I've been working on that in the afternoons when I get back home. And I haven't posted any pictures, and I promised you I would, and I apologize for that. But I will post some pictures as soon as I can. I get in there and I get into the garage, and I get so wrapped up in the project that I do forget about taking photographs, except to send to my friend Mike, who also has a Miata about the same year as mine. His is a 90, mine's a 91. And, I send him little pictures of my progress, and the things that I'm doing and things I'm discovering, because eventually he may have to do what I'm doing to his. So I'm just kind of helping out as I can. And so I've taken a handful of photos of things that are going on, but they're not going to be of much interest to many people, because car guys, I mean, they want to work on classic Chevys and Fords and big V8 power plants, and I'm working on this little Japanese car. As I mentioned to somebody yesterday at a hardware store, when I was looking for a specific bolt, this odd size metric bolt to fasten a car part of the car back on, because I snapped a bolt. No, I'm not He-Man. It's a little bitty tiny M5 bolt, and I just got distracted and had the impact tool, or the, you know, my little DeWalt drill thing. I was just snugging bolts up and got distracted and noticed, oh, this thing is still spinning. Oh, that's because the I've snapped it off, but it wasn't down inside the metal of the piece, so I was able to get it back out and find another one and got it replaced. But as I explained to the guy who was helping me find the bolt, I'm working on a 30-year-old Japanese car, and he had asked me, can you find this stuff on the internet? I said, no, you cannot find the original parts on the internet. You just can't. I have looked for sources for the original bolts, and even direct from Mazda, I can't find original bolts, hardware. I end up having to go to the O'Reilly's Auto Part nearby and see if I can find something that's close. And so it's interesting. I want to know, at least it's interesting to me, that I'm finding metric bolts, metric threaded bolts that don't have metric sized heads. And I'm wondering why that is. Like, I'll have an M8 1.25 thread bolt. I just lost half of you right there, didn't I? I'm sorry. But I'll find a bolt of a specific size that has a specific size, like a 14 millimeter head. So I've been using a 14 millimeter socket for this particular kind of bolt. And the one with that thread has a half inch socket instead. It's not a 14 mil. It's a half inch sized head, which means that should I have to take this piece off in the future, I'll be having to swap back and forth between wrenches to get all of the bolts off. It's just a little inconvenience that I will just kick myself for later on. Anyway, such is my life. I'm at the point now with the car that I have a lot of parts back on the car. And let's see. I painted the intake manifold. I've got it reattached to the head. I've got the valves, the valve lifters. I was going to clean those valve lifters, and I had an issue with a valve lifter. I took one of them apart, and I had put it in some solvent and let it soak for a little while, and I was using the air gun to clear the solvent out of the internal parts, and it literally blew into pieces. The air pressure popped two of the parts apart, and there's a tiny spring, little bitty spring about the diameter of a human hair. And it just goes off in one direction. Another part goes in another direction. And I looked everywhere, couldn't find them. And so I've had to order more valve lifters. And that was part of the thing, was that I looked at the situation and thought, you know, it's going to cost me this much. I might as well just go ahead and replace all of them. And that way I've got brand new lifters all the way around. So the snowball gets bigger. And see, what was another thing I did? Oh, yeah. I was going to have to replace the head bolts because I know they've been used three times that I've touched them. So they're designed to be used maybe twice. Maybe you can reuse them maybe once or twice. But because they're made to stretch, when you torque them down, you can't use them more than a couple of times, two or three times. So I was going to have to buy head bolts. So I went ahead and bought studs. And if you've worked on cars, you know the difference. It's not just a bolt that goes down through. It's a stud you mount into the block of the car, and then you lower the head and everything down on top of the studs. And that makes the reassembly process much easier because you're not in danger of tearing gaskets up by moving things the wrong way. Anyway, it all slides into place perfectly that way. It costs a lot more, but it's better. It's just a better way to do things. And what else is there? That's all together. I've got the timing gear, the main timing gear on the crank replaced. I'm at the point now where I'm waiting for parts, which will be here Wednesday. And when those parts come in, hopefully I should have the car back together by this weekend and I'll be done with it. And hopefully driving smoke-free. And if it's not smoke-free, then I've invested a lot of days and a pile of bills into improving parts of the car that didn't need to be improved. Oh, but also I'd mentioned one of the power steering boots was ripped and torn. I got into that. And I'm still in the middle of that. And in that process, I found out that the tie rod ends on both sides are shot and the upper ball joints are shot. So, as I told my friend Mike, I just need to stop working on his car because the longer I work on it, the more I find to work on. Could be worse. I could be Don Lemon. Oh, I know you've heard this story by now that Don Lemon actually said, the other day, and by the way, he's not a journalist. He is a left wing hack on CNN, and he should at the very least be careful about blaspheming Jesus Christ. If not for the sake of his own soul, then so as not to get torn to shreds by one of the softest spoken and mild mannered pundits you'll ever see on TV. NFL Hall of Famer Tony Dungy. I've had the pleasure of meeting Tony Dungy. I ran sound for something he spoke at one time. Nice guy. Well, Don Lemon, who follows Chris Cuomo during CNN's primetime lineup, inexplicably claimed on the air, in front of God and everybody, on a TV camera, that Christians believe Jesus Christ was not perfect. Well, for anybody with even the most elementary theological knowledge of Christianity, the patent absurdity of that statement is obvious. Quote, Jesus Christ, if that's who you believe in, Jesus Christ admittedly was not perfect when he was here on this earth. That's what he told Chris Cuomo during their nightly transition segment together, you know, moving from one show to the next. And then he proceeded to make a bizarre comparison between Jesus and slave owners. I'm not going to go into any more of his idiocy. I'll just move right on to what Tony Dungy said. He said, I'm sorry, Mr. Lemon, but just who admitted that Jesus Christ was not perfect here on earth? Not anyone who believes the Bible, not anyone who trusts in Jesus as their Savior. I'm not sure what the point you're making is, but your premise is dead wrong. That was the point in Jesus coming. Actually, that those five words, your premise is dead wrong, could be applied to the vast majority of what Don Lemon says. And in case you're not familiar, the reason that Jesus' perfection is important is because in the system of the religion of the Jewish people, a perfect sacrifice had to be made in order to cover their sin. And in order to the lamb that was sacrificed had to be blemish free. It could not be lame. It could not have any problems. It couldn't be sick. It had to be absolutely perfect. And as a symbol of that same perfection in sacrifice, God came to earth, walked the earth as Jesus, lived a perfect life, was perfect in every way, made no mistakes, transgressed in no way, and on the hill of Golgotha was sacrificed and his blood shed as the ultimate perfect sacrifice for the sin of all mankind. And that is the core of the perfection of Jesus Christ and why Christians believe that he was perfect. It's biblical. It's written out in the Bible. It's explained in detail. The types of sacrifice that were made historically by the people of Israel were very important. And so God showed to them, this is the way things are. This is the last sacrifice I'll accept. Believe in this, cling to this, and your sin will be forgiven. No need to shed the blood of innocent animals anymore. I've done this for you. And Don Lemon completely and totally is ignorant of the premise and the purpose and the entire rationale behind the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. Which proves he doesn't not only know about God. He doesn't know God. And taking anything he has with any kind of weight or importance is a waste of time and energy. Don Lemon is a prime example of progressive thought. Don Lemon should know better, but obviously he doesn't. Good for Tony Dungy, who said, read your Bible, which says in 2 Corinthians 5:21, the New Living Translation, for God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin, so that we could be made right with God through Christ. To Don Lemon, this is what Christians believe. And no Christian has ever, no one who really knows God and who has that personal relationship has ever sad. Well, admittedly, Jesus wasn't perfect. Don Lemon is in deep need of the forgiveness which was paid for on the cross by the perfection of Jesus Christ. You can be mad at him if you want to. But if you're offended, it's because you decided to be offended. So don't be offended. Mr. Lemon needs our prayers. He needs to really know the man who paid the ultimate debt, the ultimate price for his sin.
Everything is awesome.
Well, that's what they tell me.
Everything is cool when you're part of a team.
That's what they say.
Everything is awesome when we live in our dreams.
All right. It's the Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast, the 13th day of July, 2020. And I hope everything is awesome for you and for yours. Well, Don Lemon was our first step into the world of the absurd, and I've got one more before we get into other stuff. And that is Robert De Niro, his lawyer. Robert De Niro's lawyer says he, the Hollywood star, who looks to make $7.5 million this year alone, says he's struggling. Struggling, I tell you. He's struggling because his chain of restaurants called Nobu are tanking because of COVID-19. Because of COVID-19, De Niro's restaurants are suffering. And Robert De Niro, even though the restaurants are struggling, he's still going to make $7.5 million this year. He's struggling. And that's after his restaurant chain received roughly $28 million in more than a dozen relief fund payments. It seems that capitalism has been very good to Mr. De Niro through movies and the restaurant business. Without capitalism, he would not have the luxurious life he lives. He also wouldn't have the platform to openly curse President Trump. And he's taken advantage of a Trump program intended to help small businesses survive the pandemic. Robert De Niro is absurd, as well as being a raging psycho hypocrite. So when you see the stories about Robert De Niro's restaurants struggling, remember, he's gotten about $28 million in help from your tax dollars, your taxes, the money they take out of your paycheck, the money you cut a check for every year to the IRS. He has gotten $28 million of those dollars to help his restaurant chain. This multimillionaire, who will make $7.5 million this year. And his lawyer says he's struggling. Do you honestly believe that Robert De Niro knows what it means to struggle financially? Do you? This guy who was in, you remember him for one of the Godfather movies. It was Godfather 2 and other movies. He's been around doing things for quite some time. He's a very successful actor. In any kind of economy besides a capitalist economy, he would be living in a little one-room apartment someplace and making public appearances because he's famous, but not much else. I mean, he might drive a slightly nicer car, but Mr. De Niro is living the life of luxury, but he's struggling because his restaurants are having trouble. Bless his heart. You know, it just sounds like life is going to be tough for him. It really does sound like life is, well.
This sounds like it's going to be hard.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for Mr. De Niro. I just don't know how he could possibly. I mean, how, I want details.
I want details, and I want them right now.
How is he going to survive on only $7.5 million this year? How? I just, I just want to know, how is Mr. De Niro going to survive?
What a bunch of crap.
Yeah, pretty much. One thing that is not a bunch of crap is that restaurants in general across America are suffering. Months after state and local governments threw communities into strict lockdowns, we're finally seeing the long-term damage the protective measures are having on the economy. Protective measures. Am I the only one that doesn't believe this was actually the big thing they said it was? I'm telling you, the more I see, the more I hear, the more stories I see in the news and that are being ignored by the news, the more convinced I am that this was just an opportunity for leftist politicians to flex their muscles and see how far they could go. Well, according to data compiled by Yelp, late last month, several industries were rocked by fallout from the pandemic. The retail and restaurant sectors appear to be the most severely impacted. For restaurants, closures peaked in March as leaders ordered restrictive lockdowns on businesses. Of the 23,981 eateries that have closed down since March, 53% of those closures are indicated as permanent as of June 15th, according to Yelp. 53% of restaurants will not open again. That's what that means. 53%. Restaurants run on thin margins, and sometimes they can take months or even years to break even. That results in this higher rate of permanent closures. There's just not a pad to fall back on. We talk about living from paycheck to paycheck. People in the restaurant business, unless they have the deep pockets of a national chain owned by a big corporate conglomerate, people in the restaurant business are literally working from week to week, month to month, making sure they can pay their employees and pay their bills, because the margins are not that big. They're not making a ton of money, just in general. These broad shutdowns contributed to record-breaking unemployment claims, and that compounded the economic devastation. The restaurant industry wasn't the only one to be decimated by the coronavirus pandemic. While a lower overall percentage of shuttered retail businesses are now permanently closed, Yelp's report says a total of 27,663 restaurants that were open March 1st were marked closed either temporarily or permanently as of June 15th. As the data continues to pour in, there's no telling how big of an impact lockdowns and closures will have on the American economy. Although many businesses have endured, low revenue and mounting rent make for an uncertain future. Maybe you have a favorite restaurant that they managed to stay afloat or are trying to stay afloat just by doing phone-in business, pickup business. That's happened with us. My wife Jane and I have a couple of places that we have enjoyed for a long time that are doing what they can to survive just on pickup orders. And my favorite barbecue spot, I've mentioned it a few times here. It's called Barbecue Stop. These guys, they actually at least once a year go to barbecue competitions and they come back with trophies. And their sauces are just amazing. They have some of the most amazing barbecue sauces, a bunch of different flavors. And they, because they couldn't open their dining area, just did pickup business for a while. And they stayed fairly busy, but I know they weren't making the same amount of money. There's a little Japanese place that we go to from time to time that just recently opened their dining area back up again. And all they could do was just try to keep a couple of people, two or three people employed, putting together pickup orders. They're just trying to stay above water. And this is happening everywhere. And sadly, some of the places couldn't make enough money doing that to stay afloat. It's just, I think this may be the beginning, the tip of the iceberg. With coronavirus infections blooming now in several states, it's likely that a new round of shutdowns could put even more businesses and jobs in jeopardy. It will undoubtedly be easier for restaurants geared toward takeout and delivery to weather the storm than for places like upscale steakhouses, buffets, and bars to stay in business. Even more damning for many restaurants dependent on indoor dining, some of the latest evidence points to poor ventilation as a factor in the spread of COVID-19. And this is a point that attentive health officials should be taking notice of. I mean, this is in show notes today, and I want you to take a look at it because there is actually a little, there's a graph that, or an illustration that shows a restaurant, a particular scenario in restaurant ventilation and how somebody who is infected but not symptomatic can sit at a table and the air conditioning system can blow their infection around to more tables and more people get infected. And it's an interesting situation. And it's a sad situation. Now, considering what we are learning now, that the vast majority of the infections are asymptomatic, and that the vast majority of people who catch COVID-19 or catch the coronavirus don't wind up in the hospital, they don't wind up in severe condition, and a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a percentage of people are actually dying, we should probably reopen practically everything and just tell people to use their brains and be cautious. And that would help the restaurant industry. Will that happen? I wouldn't bet on it. Welcome back. It's the Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast for the 13th of July, 2020. Mark Congleton here. Good to have you along. Thanks for being part of the fun. I appreciate the fact that you're listening. Thanks for sharing with your friends. Scanning social media during the break, James Woods posted to Twitter, "Reading the news is a soul-crushing experience and pure misery. The mainstream media have slowly, silently degraded journalism into sheer bald-faced propaganda with stealth and guile. They are like diseased weasels prowling in the night." Very well put, Mr. Woods. Very well put. Once again, I have to tell you, don't get your news from the news. Find some other place besides the mainstream progressive press to find your information. Once you do it for just a short time, a week or so, you venture out beyond the safe spaces that you've trusted for so many years, you'll start developing a good gut for what's real and what isn't. I suggest you get started on your new gut today. Wow, Thomas Massey tweets, in just 120 days, the so-called experts went from only healthcare professionals can effectively use a mask to even kids in grade school can effectively use a piece of cloth. Wow, how true is that? I've been watching with interest videos of a handful of YouTubers who specialize in, they're Disney freaks, I'll just put it that way. These guys love the Disney parks, and especially around Orlando, the amusement parks in the Orlando area, and I follow them because I've been a Disney fan for quite some time. And I've explained this to you that not so much anymore, because spontaneity is gone. You can't just go and on a whim enjoy a day in a Disney park. You have to actually make reservations now. You have to do fast passes in advance. You have to, if you don't fast pass your attractions, you will stand in line for much, much longer. I know you're probably with me if you've been to a Disney park where you've stood in the standby line and watched as groups of dozens and dozens of fast passers pass you while you stand and wait. The fast pass process has actually made the wait for getting on rides even longer than before. It's just the only thing I can think, well, they're going to have to do the virtual queue thing, which is what the fast pass basically is. But they're going to have to tie it to your mobile device, and it's going to have to apply to all riders, not just some, but all. Where you come up, you get your virtual place in a virtual queue, and you come back. when it's your time. Not just some, but all. That's the only way that's going to work, or just eliminate it altogether. But spontaneity is gone. You can't get a reservation. You can't just walk up and get a hot dog. Well, you can at Casey's Corner, but you're going to be waiting in line if they ever open it again, because it's not open. Anyway, I've been watching with interest as they've been posting the opening days. They had an annual pass holder preview day last Thursday, and then they opened for regular business on Saturday, and the crowd levels are just ridiculous. I told my wife Jane as we were watching the other day, one over the weekend, I said, this reminds me of that time years ago we went in January, the first week in January. We were watching as all the New Year revelers were leaving the park as we drove in, and we checked into our hotel, and we walked on everything. I think the longest we waited in line for anything might have been 15 minutes, and that's what it looked like to me. There's just so much open space and so few people there. And they were talking, the YouTubers were talking, well, all but one of them were talking about how great this was. And I was thinking, wow, Disney's losing tons of cash. But masks, this is the point of me rambling here. The masks is seeing how they're requiring people to wear masks. And we have people in my city, in Birmingham, Alabama. If you're in Jefferson County, which is the county Birmingham is in, you have to wear a mask if you go out in public. You have to wear a mask if you're shopping. You have to wear a mask all these different places. If you're sitting down to eat someplace, yeah, you can take your mask off, but you have to wear a mask. And so I keep one in the console of the car. Usually got one in the pocket of my shirt. So I have masks. And I wear one not because I believe in them, but I wear one because legally, basically, I have to. And in today's environment, somebody could point me out and snitch on me. And the next thing you know, I'm dealing with some bureaucratic numbskull who is feeling their power. And so, ugh. But here we are, faced with wearing masks all over the place. And then in California, they're going to release prisoners. And they're doing it more than California. You just hear about it because California is high profile. But they're going to release prisoners because of COVID. Why not just issue the prisoners masks? These violent criminals, give them masks. Require that they wear the masks in prison. I'll tell you why. Because one, they won't wear the masks. And two, this is part of the Marxist plan to undermine America, is you just keep releasing the violent felons out onto the street. And those violent felons will do the work of disruption for the Marxists who want everything to change. So the whole thing about masks is actually ludicrous. It's just crazy when you actually look at the science about it. It's just nuts. I feel like I'm rambling, and I apologize for that. Let me get back to something. I saw this on Twitter earlier today, and it's in the show notes today, and I want you to have it. So make sure you get the show notes. It's about a study from Iceland. Now, we're seeing a lot of people talking today about reopening the schools, and I keep seeing people posting about protecting our precious children. And, well, those kids are going to catch, they're going to be asymptomatic and bring it home to the adults. And this is what's spreading on social media. This fear-mongering on social media about reopening the schools and getting our kids back out there. Let me tell you something. It's extremely important to get these kids back into social activity with their friends again, because these kids are, they need that. We, as far back as we have been social, as long as we've been around each other, we thrive on that social activity, one with another. Even the children, the little children, thrive on being social with other people, and being isolated is not good for them. Well, coming from Twitter, from a guy named Newman Nahas, he's got a thread here, and I may not get through all of it. There's a lot of charts and stuff, but I'm going to get you the stuff around all of the illustrations. Okay. First up, the most important evidence regarding pediatric transmission is coming from Iceland in their study published in NEJM. Be suspicious of any expert ignoring this paper and discussing anecdotes instead. The data for the study comes from Iceland's systematic screening of its population. It was based on a population representative sample identified without respect to symptomatic status and a sample based on presence of symptoms. The study isolated SARS-CoV-2 samples from every positive case, sequenced the genome of the virus, and tracked the mutation patterns. This analysis, along with contact tracing, allowed the authors to identify definitively who passed the virus to whom. This is unique. Based on this, the senior author concluded that, quote, even if children do get infected, they are less likely to transmit the disease to others than adults. We have not found a single instance of a child infecting parents. This is huge. The genetic analysis in this study is the most direct evidence of the direction of transmission, and this evidence shows that children must be less likely to transmit than adults. No other way to view this. These data are basically irrefragable. Note, your cousin's friend who heard about some stuff almost certainly didn't sequence any genomes. The same is true of the news reports of isolated instances of school outbreaks, though these accounts usually proclaim hysterically that children are super spreaders. Their conclusions seem never to be based on actual tracing, much less deeper genetic analysis. Never. Yet, these stories are getting more press than Iceland. This is especially weird here, as Iceland is not an outlier. Its results are also corroborated all over the world. In fact, at this point, so many data sets on point, it's overwhelming. Here are two examples. Ireland. Researchers compared infected children with infected adults. Despite identifying a total of 722 contacts for the infected children, the study found not a single instance of an infected child passing on the virus. In contrast, the adults who were infected had many fewer contacts, only 102, and yet they did pass on the infection. The Netherlands. A report by the Ministry of Health in the Netherlands, based on the extensive contact tracing data there, also found almost no disease spread by infected patients 20 and under at all. The authors of the study concluded, quote, data from the Netherlands confirms children play a minor role in the spread of the novel coronavirus. The virus is mainly spread between adults and from adult family members to children. The spread of COVID-19 among children or from children to adults is less common. Thus, we are faced with two hypotheses. One, children play an equal role in transmission. And two, children play a meaningfully reduced role in transmission. The data sets go with number two. Now, there is more to this, and I think you should read it. Because, again and again around the world, we're seeing examples. We're seeing proof. We're seeing scientific proof, if I might add, that we should open the schools. Our kids need to get back to school. Because the kids aren't catching it from each other or passing it on to adults. So all of the fear-mongering you're seeing about opening the schools is baseless. Oh my. Now I want to watch Back to the Future. Diving into the final segment for this Monday, the 13th day of July, 2020. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Congleton here with you. I'm glad you're along. It's good to be back. And again, I apologize for being out of touch. Wow. I really honestly didn't anticipate being gone for 3 whole days last week, but such is life. Things are back to Abby normal now, and that's good news. At least I hope so. Today, let's see, what's the rest of today? I have some production to do when we get through here. That'll take me up to lunch today, and then after lunch, back into my getting greasy clothes and working on the car again. I gotta show it who's boss, because it's fighting me on something. By the way, I just shared the story about pediatric COVID spread. I just shared that to social media. It's on the Facebook page. I should automatically share it with Twitter. I'll double check and make sure, though. But please, double check that. Take a look at it. It goes beyond what I just finished sharing with you. There's charts. There's all kinds of stuff there. Let's see. How much further was there? There was something about the different hypotheses. Hypothesis 1 explains the stories out of Israel and other isolated cases seeing of seeming pediatric spread. And then hypothesis two could explain everything. It explains Ireland and the stories of pediatric transmission, because it doesn't deny the possibility of pediatric spread. It just suggests it's a lower problem. It's so small, it's hard to measure, in fact. Looking at the set of evidence taken as a whole, the obvious hypothesis that jumps out is not that children must play an equal role in transmission, but rather that children must play a reduced role. So kids aren't getting it, and they aren't passing it. That's basically the gist of this. And that's what the data from Iceland and other places is telling us, that kids, of all of us, the kids are the safest. And that's what we're learning. So take a look at that today. And share it around, okay? All right. Now, did you see what's happening? The latest cancel culture thing that's happening. Because the head honcho of Goya Foods was thankful for the president and his leadership. Now the left has decided he has no right to be in business. It's insane. Coming from Daily Wire, could Goya Foods be headed toward the Chick-fil-A effect, wherein the more leftists hate it, the more conservatives buy it? Well, that just may well be the case. Following Goya CEO Robert Unanue's expressed Trump support and the left's subsequent threats of boycott, the company, it's Hispanic-owned, by the way, of the company, the customers have actually been buying the product as a counter-protest. It's been described as a boycott as opposed to a boycott. According to Fox Business, the boycott began when radio host Michael Pelka encouraged people on Twitter to buy up to 10 bucks and buy up 10 bucks worth of Goya food products. He said, "My brother came up with a terrific idea. I'm encouraging all to join me in purchasing 10 bucks worth of Goya food products and donating them to your local food bank. Let's push a boycott, not a boycott. Let's show the Goya away people what compassion can do." That tweet reached over 27,000. It got 27,000 likes, prompted a lot of people on conservative side, the commentators, to promote the campaign, like Mark Levin, "Go out today and buy your Goya foods." Marco Rubio said, "Most of these people fronting the Goya boycott either don't use Goya food anyway, and most of the ones who do will cave." On Saturday, a GoFundMe account was launched to raise money to feed the hungry using Goya food products. 43 grand since it opened. 43,000. Casey Harper, who studied the GoFundMe, said, "I'm not surprised we've raised so much because people are tired of having to walk on eggshells in political discourse. Also, Americans are fundamentally generous people, so a chance to feed the hungry and stand up to cancel culture was an easy win." The controversy over Goya foods erupted last week, of course, and you know the story. I told you earlier already. So I'm also seeing, besides this one story, this one article, I've been seeing on social media, like on Twitter over the weekend, picture after picture after picture from supermarkets, from Walmarts, from different places of the sections where Goya Foods are They're empty. Just a few cans here and there left over. Just tons of stuff gone. Why? Because right-thinking, sane, conservative people, people who behave like real adults, are going into their grocery stores and they're buying Goya products. They're emptying the shelves. Because they are sick and tired of the cancel culture. They're sick and tired of these people who are telling us what we can do and what we can't do, what we can buy, what we can't buy, where we can eat or not. We're sick of it. We're sick and tired of it. And as a result, we're going to show everybody, well, fine. You say no, we say go. Just like with Chick-fil-A. Remember when they tried to cancel Chick-fil-A everywhere? Chick-fil-A did some banner business. It's time to do it again. Now, Dennis Prager, he is just a brilliant man. And he wrote an article about racism and hoaxes. And I want to share some of it with you before we move along. See, is there anything else I need to do? Okay, this is a good thing to end on. He says, as I wrote nearly 3 years ago, perhaps the second greatest libel, and certainly the most widespread, is that America is a racist country that oppresses its minorities and women. We can call it the American libel. The greatest libel was the infamous blood libel, the fabricated charge spread in Europe for hundreds of years by anti-Semite Christians that Jews kill Christian children to use their blood to make matzos, unleavened bread, for Passover. That was a huge lie. But if America is so racist, why are there so many race hoaxes? Virtually every time we read about a swastika painted on a door or a noose hanging from a tree to taunt blacks, it turns out to be either a false alarm or, more frequently, a hoax. Here are a dozen examples. Number one, the Duke lacrosse team, 2006. Three white members of the Duke University lacrosse team were falsely accused by Crystal Magnum, a black student at North Carolina Central University, with having raped her. The charges were all fabricated, but the American media and Duke University faculty rushed to judgment and devoted months to smearing the three lacrosse players and Duke University itself as racist. Number two, UC San Diego Library, the noose, in 2010. Student apologizes for noose in UC San Diego Library. That's from the LA Times. A minority student was responsible for placing the noose in the university library. Previously, the AP reported anger boiled over on the University of California San Diego campus today, where students took over the chancellor's office to protest the hanging of a noose in a campus library. Yep, it was a hoax. Number three, a truck at Oakland Corporation Yard in 2014, a reported noose tied to the back of a city truck in August. That stirred already simmering racial tensions at Oakland's Corporation Yard. Was not an intended act of racial harassment, according to a city commissioned report. Number four, 2015, the University of Delaware, nooses found hanging on a University of Delaware campus were actually lanterns. Number five, 2015, the LSU noose, widely reported that a noose was sighted at Louisiana State University leading to protests against racism there. Later reported, LSU said a picture of what appeared to be a noose hanging from a campus tree Thursday was not what it appeared to be. Number six, 2016, the University at Albany, a state appeals court, upheld the University of Albany's expulsion of a woman who, along with two friends, falsely claimed to be the victim of a racially motivated attack on a CDTA bus in January of 2016. The three black women had attacked a white woman and then claimed they had been racially attacked. Number seven, Bowling Green State University, 2016. Bowling Green say a student lied about a politically driven attack. The day after the 2016 election, Elisha Long, a student at Bowling Green State, about 90 miles west of Oberlin, said she was attacked by white Trump supporters who threw rocks at her. Police concluded she fabricated the story. Number eight, by the way, there are a dozen of these. Number eight, the dreadlock cutting hoax of 2019. A black student at a Christian school in Virginia who accused three white sixth grade boys of cutting her dreadlocks and calling her ugly now says she was lying about the attack. Number nine, Jussie Smollett, 2019. You know that story. It was a hoax. The noose was a rope his two co-conspirators purchased for staging an attack. Number 10, Oakland's Lake Merritt in 2020. After the city of Oakland launched a hate crime investigation regarding a noose hanging from park trees, Victor Anare Senbe, a black man, tweeted, "It's not a noose. This guy climbed the tree and put up the rope for a swing months ago. Folks use it to exercise. It's not a noose." Nevertheless, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, tweeted, "Intentions do not matter. We will not tolerate symbols of hate in our city. The nooses found at Lake Merritt will be investigated as hate crimes." So you see, it doesn't matter what the reality is. You see? And then, of course, you know about, at Talladega, Bubba Wallace and the noose, which was actually just a loop and a rope used as a door pull. Then there's the University of Laverne. Racist threats of attacks that rattled California University campus were faked, according to the police. And you know what? There are more stories. They won't fit in a column. But it seems like all of these racial attacks that we're hearing about, all of this hate, the vast majority of it is a hoax. There is so little racism in America today, they're having to make it up. And that's all for today. God bless you. Have a good one. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Tuesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Join me then, why don't you? Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.